One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
We are special breakfast people here at Pantsuit Politics, but not just when Beth and I are on the road. The truth is, I want something warm from the oven every Saturday morning and Sunday morning. It's just the truth. It makes it feel special, makes it feel exciting. I don't want to work at it. So the first time I ever saw Wild Grain, which is bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, and artisanal pastries, I was obsessed. You guys, I've been a member for over a year. It's amazing. It's so easy. Every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less, no thawing required. You can fully customize your Wild Grain box. You can choose any combination of breads, pastas, pastries. You can even build a box of only breads, only pastas, or only pastries if you'd like. And for a limited time, you can get $30 off the first box, plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/pantsuit to start your subscription. Sometimes I make one single croissant just for me because I want to feel special, and they're so good. You heard me. Free croissants in every box. And $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/pantsuit. That's wildgrain.com/pantsuit. Or you can use promo code pantsuit at checkout.
Welcome to Pantsuit Politics, where a woman from the right
and a woman from the left accessorize the news with a fresh perspective. This is Sarah Holland from the left.
And Beth Silvers from the right.
Welcome to another episode of Pantsuit Politics. We are excited to have everyone with us. We've had great contact with everybody online through Facebook and Twitter. And we absolutely love engaging with everybody. So if you haven't already, like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. We're at Pantsuit Politic because Twitter stinks and it cut off our character limit. But that's where you can find us online. And as always, please give us great reviews on iTunes and subscribe. It helps other people find Pantsuit Politics.
We also want to encourage you to check out the book, The Selfie Vote, about how millennials are reshaping the electorate. This book is by Kristen Solstice Anderson. Kristen is a Republican strategist and pollster, has very interesting things to say about demographics and the way demographics are influencing the electorate. And I am so excited that she is going to be joining us in a couple of weeks. So we'd love for that episode to be a little bit like a book club where we're able to have a discussion both during the podcast with her and then around the podcast with all of you online.
So we'll put a link to the book in the show notes and you guys can check it out.
I think you'll love it. I'm reading it and I like practically have my head fall on the floor because I'm nodding it so much. It's really, really, really good.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm going to start it tomorrow.
So we're going to jump into... I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Start over. Go ahead.
Okay, we're going to jump into the pearls now and just touch on maybe not the most serious news ever, but Carly Fiorina had a tweet during the Rose Bowl that is going to go down as like the Carly tweet all capitalized, I think, because it was just such an error in judgment. So Carly is a Stanford alum. And as you may or may not know, I did not until I started following
this tweet.
I did not know. Stanford and Iowa were playing in the Rose Bowl and Carly tweets, "Love my alma mater, but rooting for a Hawkeyes win today." And this immediately was met with some of the most scathing Twitter replies I've ever seen, followed very shortly by blog posts. And the reaction was just enormous. And clearly it was unacceptable pandering. I think people feel that sports are even more sacred. Like, you can pander about lots of things, but you can't pander about sports. I don't know. What I was interested in about this was whether this backlash was more significant because it was directed at a female candidate than it might be at a male candidate. Sarah, what do you think about that?
I mean, my presumption is always, yeah, they're getting an unfair, I like to play the woman card, as Donald Trump is so capable of threatening people for doing. So, yeah, I definitely think she got an unfair reaction, especially because the more I think about it, the more it's so obviously pandering. I think she was probably joking. Like, I think that no one really believes she's not rooting for her alma mater anymore. So, I mean, I think she was making a little nudge, nudge Iowa joke, and it's just a Twitter joke. I don't understand what the big deal is.
She said that to Dana Bash today. So she was interviewed about this, and she said that it was tongue in cheek. But then here's what she said that I did not like. She said, "Oh, for heaven's sake, Dana, for heaven's sake, can't a girl have a little bit of fun?" That to me does not sound like Carly Fiorina at all.
Agreed.
So I did not love that aspect of it, but it was kind of a fun and light way to start the new year with a little mini political scandal, I guess, even though you're right. It's just a tweet. Like, we can all move on.
Let's all calm down.
So a little bit more significant is the situation that's unfolding in Oregon right now. And we are recording this podcast on Sunday night. So this situation could develop pretty substantially before our podcast is published. So here's what we know today. There is a militia group that has seized the headquarters of a federal wildlife refuge in Oregon. They have apparently quite the arsenal of weapons and are recruiting other people to join them there. This dispute is purportedly about land rights, which are becoming an increasingly big deal out west.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Sarah. I mean, land rights and eminent domain and all of that stuff sounds like first-year law school to me. It doesn't sound like, hey, let's grab our guns and occupy a federal building.
Well, I do. I mean, there's a long history of people doing this over similar issues, right? Those other similar standoffs because people feel like they can build up arsenals and the government doesn't look kindly on that.
Well,
but
really
I don't think this was
mean.
This wasn't about – this wasn't the tobacco and firearms people, though. This was something different, right?
Yeah, this is an issue that I think it looks like it's mostly about ranching. This goes back to Cliven Bundy, who was arrested previously. And these guys were arrested. There was an appeal. They were sentenced to a longer term. I need to do more research to get totally into the details of this story. But the thing I want to say is this to me is an issue that so clearly should be funneled through our normal process. If you don't like this, run for office, call your congressman. Like, this is, I don't understand a violent reaction over this.
Well, I think it's safe to say, Beth, that these people might not share many of the same outlooks and philosophies that we do.
I think that's a fair point.
I don't think these people are looking for a reasonable solution. I think these people are looking for a revolution, and I don't think it's going to go their way. I'll just be real honest. They never do.
Yeah, I have some fear about this situation because the way they've used social media, I think these guys are looking for attention, and they're not getting it, which also concerns me because I read a lot of tweets today that said something to the effect of, if these were African Americans, if these were Black Americans, if these were Muslim Americans, do you think this story would be all over the Sunday shows? And the answer is yes, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't. I mean, I think that the major networks' coverage of this has been alarmingly inadequate. And my fear is that they're going to amp it up to get the kind of press they're looking for.
Yeah.
But I hope I'm wrong. I pray that I'm wrong.
Well, we'll closely watch this one for sure.
So now we're going to move on to the part of the pearls where we choose a person from the other side to pay a compliment. So, Sarah, do you want to start us off?
I'm going to start with John McCain. I have always liked John McCain. except for this small moment in time, particularly during the Republican primary when he ran for office, when he was saying things that were completely out of character. I prefer the John McCain as frequent guest on The Daily Show. I just think that he's a smart, authentic, honest guy. I think that got lost a lot in the primary and the presidential campaign. I don't know why he picked Sarah Palin as a running mate. I don't think that helped him any. But, you know, I hope and I think that John McCain's legacy will be much larger than some of his less than stellar decision making during the presidential run. Because overall, I think he's been a great senator and continues to be a great senator. And while I don't agree with every decision he makes, I think that he's a man of integrity.
Well, I want to compliment Bernie Sanders, so another kind of pillar of the United States Senate. I really appreciate how Bernie has handled himself in terms of the sort of opposition research aspect of running for president. I like that he's had a number of opportunities to just really lay into Hillary Clinton, and he always conducts himself as a gentleman. And today, he had several inquiries about whether sort of the Bill Clinton White House scandal years are relevant to this campaign. And he keeps saying, like, we have bigger and more important things to talk about than Bill Clinton's sex life. And I just can't say amen.
I think he might have listened to our podcast last week.
I'm hopeful that he did. But if he's listening again this week, thumbs up, Bernie. I appreciate how adult you are about all this.
Keeps taking the high road at one time after the other.
He has. And really, it's a good example.
Yeah, and I think that it speaks to his authenticity, not only when he's, you know, he wouldn't be the first to say and to do successfully the whole, like, you know, small donations, it's a grassroots campaign. And that's, I'm not saying that's important, but I do feel like he, by taking the high road in this way, he's doing something sort of new and refreshing that even, you know, President Obama didn't do when he was running against Hillary Clinton, didn't always take the high road. And so I really respect him for that.
He also, I think this goes with, he really is a campaign of ideas.
He is.
I don't agree with any of those ideas, but he's not trying to be a celebrity. You know, he's not trying to be a rock star. He just has these ideas, and he really
believes them. Despite the Bernie Bros' best efforts, they're trying so hard to make him a rock star, those Bernie Bros.
It's just not what he's about, and I respect that about him very much.
Well, Beth, we've decided to kick off the new year in a big way, and up next in a suit, we're going to talk about abortion and reproductive rights.
Example of how shy we are,
and we're gonna take it slow in 2016. We're gonna kick off the year with really, you know, only one of the most controversial issues in American politics, and not just America, worldwide.
Right.
So
hopefully we can do this in a new way, in a way that that feels like it has some value instead of just being sort of the same tired back and forth.
Of course, I have faith in us. Well, I'm going to start. So we're each going to kind of say where we're coming from and then move forward from there. So I'm going to kick it off. I am pro-choice. I was raised conservative Southern Baptist, and so was passionately pro-life through high school until I got to college and became a women's studies minor and learned a lot of things that I felt fundamentally questioned my assumptions about abortion and women who choose to have abortions. This was solidified when I graduated from college and worked at Planned Parenthood of Central North Carolina. I ran their emergency contraception hotline. At the time, emergency contraception was available only through prescription. So women would call in to the hotline and I would take down their information and get them a prescription. I like to say that I prevented more abortions in that 1 year than most people will in their whole entire lives. By preventing actual pregnancies. So During my time at Planned Parenthood, I worked primarily in the office, but the office was attached to a clinic and we did trainings and I worked closely with women who, you know, my boss had been there since Roe v. Wade was overturned. And so I kind of saw a real life up close and personal look at the pro-choice movement. And I think that it was primarily a political position at the time that I felt was supportive of a woman's right to choose and a woman's right to have control over her own body. I think that that decision and my thinking about abortion has grown in depth, but not changed in position since I've had my own children, and particularly since I lost a pregnancy at 16 weeks. Mm-hmm. I think that I always liked Anna Quinlan's quote that my position on abortion didn't change when I had children, because I thought, no, this is something you really need to choose to do because it's so difficult. But I think when you talk about abortion, there has to be two different discussions. And one is the legislative reality, the pragmatic reality of women will not have pregnancies and will not have babies that they do not want to have. My boss at Planned Parenthood once told me, you know, she said, if I had a nickel for every woman who came up into this clinic with a cross around her neck who said, I don't believe in abortion, but I can't have this baby, I'd be rich. So I think that, you know, there will never be an end to abortion. Abortion has existed since the beginning of time, and it will continue to exist until the end of time. We can prevent it as best we can. I'm a Clintonite to the core. Let's make it safe, legal, and rare. But the law's duty is to deal with the reality of the situation, and the reality of the situation is that women are going to want to end pregnancies. So I think that's the reality we have to deal with. And I think when you go to places like Texas and Mississippi and you eliminate those options, all you do is make it incredibly difficult for a certain class of women to get abortions. Everybody, it's a bit more difficult for everyone, but some people have resources and some people don't. And so it's really just a heavy tax on the poor in, you know, one more way with women with fewer options. And that makes me really sad. And I think that because what inevitably happens when you close abortion clinics, especially like Planned Parenthood, you're not only preventing people's access to abortion, you're also preventing their access to birth control and other reproductive options. So I think that that is one of my biggest beefs with the particularly hardcore pro-life movement, ignoring the people who try to end life in order to save life. I don't even know where to begin with those people. But, you know, especially with something like Plan B, you know, not to get into the weeds on the cycle or the physical reality of Plan B, but the only reason they have to say that emergency contraception could harm a fertilized egg is because they can't prove that that will never, ever happen. But I'm not a scientist, and so I'm comfortable saying that will never, ever happen. Just because we can't put a camera in every uterus that will ever take Plan B and promise people that it will never happen doesn't mean it's not going to happen. And it's not. The only way you, I mean, Plan B works the sooner you get it. And you're, you know, so trying to prevent access to something like that is just increasing the likelihood that someone will have a pregnancy that they would then want to end. So, you know, I'm a huge proponent of birth control and having access to that, so that's the way you prevent abortion. Now, so that is all my kind of stance on the reality of abortion, the pragmatic reality. I understand that there is a very emotional and heavy philosophical debate surrounding abortion. I'm really comfortable saying I do not have the answer to that debate. I will not claim I know when life begins, because I don't. And I am not trying to figure that out and prove that I'm right. So I think that it's an important debate to have, but I think really what happens is you have the rights of a fetus and the rights of a woman that are bumping up against each other. And, you know, in law school, that's what you kind of talk about a lot, that everybody has rights and that the conflict is, and the decisions come in is when they bump up against each other, you know. So as somebody who's carried 3 pregnancies to term and 1 to 16 weeks, I'm not going to argue that what I was carrying was just a clump of tissue. I don't believe that. But I'm also not going to argue that it was a fully formed life deserving of the same rights that I have, because I don't believe that either. And in the same way that, you know, I felt the pain I felt at a miscarriage was different and distinct from the pain I felt at a 16-week pregnancy loss, you know, I think the rights of a fetus are different depending on the stage of development. But for me, philosophically, the rights of the woman are always more important. So I don't think it's an easy debate. And I say, like, this is one of the things from my conservative Baptist past that I can easily tap into and understand where people are coming from. But just because it's difficult and we can't find this easy answer or this black and white answer doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue to talk about this in a respectful way. My very best friend is a devout Catholic and passionately pro-life, and we talk about it often, and we have really productive, great discussions. I remember, you know, we've been friends since 1999. I don't even want to do the math. A very long time. And we were talking about it not probably 6 or 8 months ago, and she said something that I still keep thinking about. She said, we were talking about, you know, kind of the fetus and the life and this philosophical debate, and I said, well, you know, whether it's a life. And she said, well, it is alive, even if we don't think it's a life. And I thought that was really, like, she's like, in the same way, you know, every cell you have is alive. So it is alive, even if it's not a life. And so, you know, I thought that was such a very insightful way to put it and to kind of think about it in a different way that I had not thought about it before. But at the end of the day, I think the philosophical discussion is important, but I don't think there's an answer. And I think the law has to deal with the reality. And the reality is that women need abortions, and they will continue to need abortions. And that's the world we live in. And that's why I'm pro-choice.
Just finished A Court of Thorns and Roses and craving another fantasy world to devour? Dipsy's got you. Dive into spicy enemies to lovers tales or embark on an epic romance between immortal fae and sworn foes. They've got fantasy romance stories perfect for your morning walk, late night, or long bath. Dipsy is an app full of short, spicy audio stories. They bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. Discover stories about second chance romances, adventurous vacation flings, and hot and heavy hookups. And there's a growing library of fantasy series with werewolves, Greek gods and goddesses, Regency era historical fiction, and fairy smut to explore the bounds of your pleasure. New content is released every week, so in between listening to your favorite stories again and again, you can always find something new to explore. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
If you're looking for a very quick salon quality, but not salon priced manicure, Olive & June has you covered. We've talked about Olive & June's Mani system before. It has everything that you need for a professional manicure in one box. Salon grade tools, your choice of 6 polishes. Those polishes are going to last you for 7 days or more. The cost breaks down to about $2 a manicure. Olive & June also has press-ons if you want. What I love, though, is that Olive & June each season is coming out with new colors, and I just got a set of spring and summer colors in quick dry polish. And they say this dries in about a minute. It seemed dry to me in about 30 seconds. It was not kidding about being quick dry. I also love the light colors in this set. There is a huge range. My favorite one is called Kitten. It's like a pinkish gray. The quick dry polish gives you full coverage in 1 or 2 coats. It lasts for more than 5 days, and it is offered in more than 40 cruelty-free and vegan polishes. Olive & June just understands what's happening in our lives, that we need to move quickly, but we want to look great and feel great and have fun in the process. Visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Mani system.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Can I get something off my chest? Every day I feel a little pang of sadness because I think about Griffin going away to college. Y'all, he's a freshman in high school. This is not healthy or normal. This is why I have it on my list of things to talk to my therapist about. We all carry around these things, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us. Therapy is a safe space. to get these things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. You gotta get it off your chest. And you can get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/pantsuit.
So I'll start on the philosophical side. I similarly think that it is very difficult. I do believe that life begins at conception, but I believe that it is life that is dependent on the mother. And it's physically dependent. It's, in my view, emotionally, spiritually, in every way dependent on the mother for some period of time. And so what happens from there, philosophically for me, is contextual. You know, I think that there are situations where abortion is wrong. I do. I believe there are situations where abortion is maybe the only humane option, depending on the kind of situation that the child would be brought into otherwise. All of those opinions are bound up in my personal beliefs about God and the universe and what's right and wrong. And so knowing that that is the makeup of my philosophical debate, I switch over to the legislative side and I say, I'm a small government Republican. I don't want anyone making decisions for me that are bound up in their own views of God and the universe and what's right and wrong. And I have to be a small government Republican, even when that means an outcome that is not my favorite outcome. You know, I think sometimes on the conservative side, we say, well, we're small government if it means these programs that we don't support coming from the government. Now, we have to mean that about this issue, too. So we can say, morally, ethically, I don't love what's happening here, but that doesn't give me the right to decide it. Government should stay out of that, just like government should stay out of whatever our other issues are. Mm-hmm. So I also agree that pragmatically, abortions are going to happen, so they should be safe and legal and rare, as you said. That's where I come out. Now, I struggle with some of the language around abortion from the pro-choice community about how, you know, we need to, I don't believe in shaming anyone. I do believe that it's okay. I read a piece, and I should have pulled it up before the show. I read a piece not too long ago about how it doesn't serve women to talk about abortion as a difficult decision. I can't get myself there. I think it should be a difficult decision for anyone, and it's a difficult issue. That said, and maybe I'm imposing my own belief system by saying that too. I just feel that legislatively, we have a decision from the Supreme Court that says what it says. We have a reality that you cannot talk about this issue without bringing your own sense of ethics, whatever they are, to it. So I don't think this is something that should be restricted by the government.
Yeah, and that's what, when you said that, when you said, the first thing I thought when you said, I think sometimes the decision to have an abortion is wrong. And the first thing I thought is, yeah, but who wants to decide that? You know, do we really want the government deciding who's right and who wrong and who deserves an abortion and who doesn't? You know?
No, I don't.
Exactly. And I think that that's in my, I wrote a post about this on my blog and I said, you know, we elevate the woman's choice and we elevate her decision because we're acknowledging that no one is better equipped to deal with that than her. You know, it might not be the decision you made, but it has to be the decision she would make based on the tools and the situation available to her. And so, because what's all the alternative? What's the alternative? You know, a government committee, who wants to sign up for that? Who are we going to put on that committee that gets to decide who gets abortions and who doesn't?
Well, so, and that goes back to sort of the whole death panel idea that conservatives made a real issue around the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, I can't reconcile an aggressively pro-life legislative agenda with my other beliefs about what government should and should not be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know. I mean, I think that, and more importantly, I'm just not sure. I don't understand how you don't acknowledge that even if the government takes an aggressively pro-life stance, that actually prevents abortion. It prevents safe abortions. I mean, I remember watching a documentary one time where this woman was like, this pro-life Mississippi woman was like, I want to live to see an end to abortion in Mississippi. That's not a thing. That's not going to happen. That's not a reality of the world that we live in, in which you end all abortion. I'm sorry. It's never going to happen. It's just not. It's been since the beginning of time, and it will continue to the end of time. If, you know, the truth of the matter is, too, and the one thing I do think that's problematic is when we tie the philosophical issues up with this, it can seep over into other medical decisions. The truth is that when I lost my baby at 16 weeks, I had an abortion. I had a D and E. I had a dilation and evacuation. That's a medical procedure that's done in abortions. Okay, so we can call it something else, but that's what the doctor did. She, you know, that's what happened. And so I'm really glad that my doctor knew how to do that. But I'll tell you what, there were several doctors that didn't, that wouldn't, that the doctor I started with and another doctor I went to couldn't do, didn't have that skill. And there's a part of me that wonders, you know, how much does this debate come into how willing doctors are to be trained in this for this procedure? If I'd been at a Catholic hospital, I don't know what the rules would have been. So it's like, you know, this, it all gets very complicated. It's not just as simple as, you know, who can do the, you know, we don't want people having abortions. It's just not that simple. It never is.
It's not that simple. We cannot criminalize everything we do not agree with. We cannot legislate ourselves into the society we wish we had. We just can't. Mm-hmm. Now, all that said, since I think that we agree that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, I thought it might be interesting to focus on a path forward that gets to that rare point. Because to me, there is a lot of pro-life work to be done, but it's on the positive side instead of the negative side.
Yeah. Well, I actually, when we talk about, I always, when I worked at Planned Parenthood, thought, man, I wish Planned Parenthood would say, okay, we're pro-choice across the board, and so we're going to open up birth centers, and we're going to really advocate for healthy pregnancy and birth.
Yeah, I think pregnancy and birth, we're just really doing ourselves disservices by the way we talk about these things and facilitate them right now. You know, we've made pregnancy adorable as a culture, right? And so I think anytime you have an experience of pregnancy that's real, it's not so adorable.
Well, and we make it in a community. You feel that when you're pregnant, that you're community property. I mean, underneath all of this is the idea that everybody, I mean, it's not to go all Handmaid's Tale on this situation, which both of us read our freshman year, Tracy, but I think that there's this ownership of women's body and their reproduction is. And I think that's, you know, a lot of times what pro-choice people are reacting to, but it's there. We're not making it up. I mean, I felt like community property the entire time I was pregnant. People felt like they could comment on my choices, on my body, on everything.
Well, and I think anytime we say something like, look at that baby bump or whatever, we're sending a message to men that isn't this cute and fun and what a great life experience.
Yeah.
And you got to be pregnant to be able to talk about what pregnancy is in a real way. And even a perfect pregnancy, it's just not all adorable. And I think this sort of cutification or something, if I can say that, really diminishes the societal perspective on what you're asking a woman to do by carrying a baby to term. And similarly, I think we have made birth this kind of nightmarish medical procedure, and that's also not accurate. You know, I think birth can be, if you have a birth in the way that you really understand and imagine having a birth, it can be a super empowering experience instead of something to be terrified of.
I mean, that you and I come from similar situations with natural birth, and you took the words out of my mouth. That's what I tell people, is I wanted to leave the situation feeling empowered instead of traumatized. And I think that gets lost so often in that. And so that, I mean, that's kind of was my original thought, is I just thought, like, how great would it be if Planned Parenthood could advocate for this? But the truth is, they're a little busy and a little strapped energy and money wise defending their current turf before they expand onto other turf.
But I think this would be a good place for pro-life groups to funnel resources to help mm-hmm. women really understand the reality of both. Pregnancy is maybe worse than we talk about it. Birth is better than we talk about it. You need to just know what's real going into both. And this gets to the next area where I think pro-life groups should give attention, which is the way we educate people about sex. And I don't think that should start in, like, a high school class where we have a big fight about abstinence-only education. I think it should start very early in terms of emotional intelligence, the way we relate to other humans. I feel like we're missing just a whole segment of development in the way we educate currently. I'm not an expert on education. I don't know what curriculum, you know, would result from what I'm talking about. But it seems to me that if you start earlier in life on sort of, here I am as a whole person. Here's what my body means to me. Here's how I relate to other people and make sense of the world. And you kind of move that along. And I'm not talking about religion or anything that truly should be done at home, but just general self-esteem, social skills, all the things that you need to be a complete person, which, let's face it, not everybody does get at home. I mean, those are hard things. I try to be a good parent, and I study a lot about being a good parent, and I'm still not sure I have those answers. So how can we supplement that in school?
Yeah, there's this really awesome movement called sex positive education that is not sex is scary, don't have sex. Because first of all, they know we're lying. And second of all, they don't listen anyway. So,
right. You
know, it's this very kind of, let's talk about real issues with consent, which gets messed totally and completely when we're all our emphasis is on sex is scary, don't have sex, and how to communicate with a partner and all these different things that says, you know, sex is a positive thing, but let's talk about how you can do it safely, and not just safely, you don't get pregnant and you don't get STDs, but safe emotionally and safe psychologically. And I think that's amazing. What really bugs me in the discussion about sex education, and truthfully, I think there's an undercurrent of it in even the abortion debate and really a lot of reproductive discussions, is this kind of, we're willing to sacrifice one kind of life for a life we find that we like better. So we're willing to sacrifice a woman for a sweet little baby. And we're willing to sacrifice the mother, even like in the discussions about birth, we're willing to sacrifice the mother's outcomes in a birth procedure just because all that matters is the healthy baby. And all these different things. And what bugs me about sex education is there's this undercurrent of, well, we're not going to talk about sex because it could encourage the good kids to have sex. Like, we know bad kids, quote unquote, are having sex. Like, we all acknowledge that kids are having sex younger and younger. But we don't really can't deal with that because we don't want to risk tainting the good kids, which is really disturbing to me. If we know kids are having sex younger and younger and that concerns us, then we need to deal with that. And we need to talk about that. And we need to educate those kids and give them birth control and just do some triage first and foremost before we worry about, quote unquote, the good kids. I mean, as a quote unquote Baptist good kid that didn't have sex for a very long time and took all that virginity stuff very seriously, the reasons people don't have sex are complex, and it's not just because there are or are not condoms laying around. So I just feel like I really hate that kind of what I feel like is what people are really saying when they say, well, we can't talk about sex in school and we can't pass out condoms because then everybody will be having sex. And what you really mean is, the kids we really value will be having sex and we care about them.
I think, though, that a lot of what you said gets to my point, which is sex does not exist in isolation for women. I can't mm-hmm. speak about that as a man because I'm not one. But sex for women is always complex. The decision to have it, to not have it, how you feel about it, all of it. And that's why I think we need a larger kind of emotional discussion beginning very early on with kids, because even the quote good kids are choosing pretty destructive relationships in a lot of contexts. Yeah. How many 4.0 high school girls have abusive boyfriends? Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of choices being made that are not healthy relationship choices.
And it's so hard too, though, because we're not just talking about relationship level or even family level. You have a whole society that sends some really mixed messages about sex.
Absolutely. So I think this kind of a more comprehensive approach to emotional intelligence, relationships generally, and then at appropriate times, in appropriate ways, sex in schools would be extremely helpful.
Well, and I think what's so hard for me when I talk about sex education and pregnancy and abortion is, you know, as a feminist, there's this really difficult line to walk between promoting self-empowerment and saying, we want you to take responsibility and we want to have these really positive experiences, but also acknowledging that there is a bigger system at work here. And there is a system that does not value women's bodies and that seeks to violate women's bodies. And it's not, you know, it's not just, you know, like I just really, it's so hard with when you talk about this stuff, not to just kind of hoist it all on the individual and say, you know, beef up your self-work and try harder, because there's bigger issues here. There's really, you know, violence against women and sexual violence against women. So I posted an article recently about a woman who got raped, and she said, you know, I was out drinking and I was out late by myself, and I was being stupid, but the punishment for stupid is not sexual assault. And so, you know, I think that there is a bigger undercurrent here that all the better sex positive education is not going to address. Well, I don't know. That's not really, maybe that's not true if you got to kids young and really talked about this, but I think that there is an undercurrent in our society of violence towards women's bodies and, you know, not valuing women's bodies that is really important and is hard to think about and hard to talk about and certainly hard to address in a positive way, but it's a seam running through all these discussions that really I think has to be talked about.
And women contribute to these problems as well. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've been thinking a lot about lately, because I see these discussions. So the same sense of control that gets exercised by people who want to prevent all abortion then seems to later manifest in things like, so we want you to be a mother so badly, but then don't breastfeed in public. You know, there are just lots of, the shame spiral just seems to get mm-hmm. larger and larger. And then we're going to criticize the way that you're parenting. And then we're going to talk about how you can't have it all by being both a mother and having a career outside the home. I mean, it's just, it is a
big... But you better try, because that's the only ring you bring value to the table. Yeah. That's the only thing we value food for.
I mean, it is really complex and layered, and I do think that so much of it comes down to shame and sort of the way that we experience first our own bodies and our own feelings. I know that mm-hmm. sounds like I can see my husband rolling his eyes right now at me, and that's okay. I mean, I understand that, but I think until we get to those issues and get to them early. And I don't mean teaching about sex in kindergarten, clearly, you know,
right.
This is just about relationships and people and your own sense of self and the way that you.
Well, I'm sure you have two little girls, so you think about this a lot. I mean, they talk about all these like body negative things start coming up as young as like 10 or 5. I mean, it seems like the number gets lower and lower every year.
I think constantly about how I talk about diet in front of my daughter, who's almost 5, about exercise, about my own body. I mean, she has questions about everything. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard. Like when I was pregnant and now that I'm after pregnant, you know, she'll make comments about my belly a lot. Mom, your belly's so big. And I have to check myself from having a negative reaction to that. Right. So I've tried to teach myself to just be neutral. Like, yeah. Yes, it is. That's what's happening right now. And that's fine. And that is unbelievably difficult, but I do feel like that is contributing to, I hope, a healthier sense of self for her than the one I had. And look, this isn't everybody gets a trophy crap. This is,
yeah,
I respect myself and I'll demand that other people respect me. And hopefully because of that, I'll make good choices that put me in loving relationships where if I get pregnant, it's because I wanted to. And if I didn't want to, I at least can look at the situation and know that if I choose to carry the child to term, that's my best option and I'll be supported in it. I mean, that's mm-hmm. a different world than the one we live in now. And that is a much better place to direct our resources than trying to wear out a Supreme Court decision or get around it with a bunch of weird regulations.
Well, and all those, regulations send the same message, which is, we do not trust you to make this decision.
Right.
You need to be here longer. You need to talk to the father. You need to talk to your parents. You need to talk to a doctor. You need to come back. I mean, every single one is, we do not trust you to make this decision. And that is problematic. That it's, you know, we talk about this sometimes with the political environment that is created by the things we say. Well, what kind of environment does it create when we pass laws like that? Because it doesn't just affect the women being, you know, that implies that that the law doesn't trust, but it affects everybody who lives in an environment in which the government is saying over and over again, we don't trust women to make decisions about their bodies. And so, I mean, I think that is just such a heavy, dangerous message to send instead of let's support everybody so everybody can make the best decision they can, you know? And so that's what sex education and that's what real healthcare support and real birth control and reproductive rights do is it supports everyone. And, you know, I wish that we all lived in a world where everybody was in loving relationships and everybody had all the resources. I mean, but it's just not the world we live in. And that's the one we have to deal with.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible. And skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I am 43, and she said, I cannot believe how young you look, and I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they make solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a double A cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. And they've even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit right. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
There's not much worse than a dry, itchy scalp. Also, when you get your hair colored and then it does not last as long as you and your stylist discussed, it could be that unfiltered, mineral-filled water is the culprit. Hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin, and about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered shower head comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered shower head. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered shower head is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze, and its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered shower head purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
What we can say right now is that just as a certain group of voices say to mothers, we don't trust you to make these choices, mothers justifiably, I think, look around at their options if they choose to carry a child to term but not raise that child and don't trust those options. Mm-hmm. Our foster care system, our adoption mm-hmm. systems, it's crazy right now. And this is another area where I think our pro-life resources would be better directed. Give people a real choice. So carrying a child to term is a huge traumatic matter. And as we said before, I think we need to talk a lot more realistically about what that means. Mm-hmm. But if you're willing to do that, I think most people's larger concern is the long-term health and well-being of a child. I don't know today if I were staring at this decision, I could say this child would be better off in foster care. I'm pretty sure I couldn't. Right. Now, there are some wonderful, amazing foster parents out there. The system itself is very scary to me.
Well, and I'd be interested to know if anyone has studied the effect of long-term maternity care. So let's say you decide to give your baby up for adoption, but you know that you have paid maternity coverage, that you won't lose your job if you have to go on bed rest, if you have all the support that makes the particularly the economic impact with the medical care of pregnancy smaller, if that would, in countries that do that, if that helps the adoption rate, if women are saying, okay, well, the physical reality of pregnancy won't be as difficult because of, better health care and real maternity and or real prenatal care and prenatal leave of some type, if that affects the decision at all. I mean, I'd be interested to know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that's the only thing that weighs on people's decision when they choose to give their baby up for adoption, but I think it has to be a part of it. Even if you want to do that, if you're going to lose your job, if you are pregnant, you're going to lose your job,
Yeah, you touched on the other factors that occur to me always, just the way we support families, the way that it impacts you professionally to be pregnant, the way it impacts you professionally to have children, the way it impacts you in every way to breastfeed or to just mm-hmm. parent. All around, I just sit back and say, if every dollar currently being spent within the pro-life movement to fight Roe versus Wade was diverted to something that intends to either prevent unwanted pregnancies or support women who carry a child to term in some way, would we not minimize the number of babies aborted? And isn't that mm-hmm. the goal?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, because that's really, it's probably even less of a factor when you're talking about adoption, but when you're choosing abortion at all. I mean, if some of the biggest factors are you can't afford the child, you can't afford the medical care. I mean, because there's no government support. I mean, no government supported daycare or paid family leave or any of these things in other industrialized nations. And I don't know how something like France or Sweden's abortion rate compares to ours, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say they're probably lower.
And look, I don't think that should all come from the government. I mean, that again is where I come back to, but we have a huge number of people spending a lot of money in this country to fight this problem. Get mm-hmm. creative, come up with some good ideas. Let me say though,
these crisis pregnancy centers are not my idea. not a long-term solution. Diapers and even if the first year of support is not going to get you through raising a kid.
Right. No, we need a lot of resources. We need to kind of go back to the drawing board, I think, mm-hmm. on how we handle this entire situation. But it can be done. And what a more productive use of our energy, you know, if our goal really, if this is about what it's supposed to be about, if the goal really is to prevent abortion, then tackle it in the way that it's going to be effective. That's my right. argument.
Well, and I think you have to, I'm not saying this for all the pro-life movement, obviously, but I do think for some hardcore pro-life activist, it's not just about, you know, saving babies, quote unquote. I think there is an undercurrent of controlling women. I do. I think that that is part of it, the motivation, consciously or unconsciously, that is fueling some of that. Because it's not, it's such an incendiary debate, and the tactics are taken are so violent and so just offensive that it's not a simple debate. And I also don't really understand, I mean, I don't think anybody is persuaded by giant placards of aborted fetuses. So I just really don't understand where they're trying to get at with that.
I don't think minds are changed in this area.
No.
If they are, it is a long, slow process. It's not a bumper sticker change. So this is another thing. It's like everything we talk about on our show. When you get into us versus them, you're stuck. And that's where mm-hmm. we are right now. And I think here, if you just say, look, what we want is fewer abortions. Let's talk about how to make that happen. Perhaps outside of the legislative process, then maybe we mm-hmm. get to a good result. Well, mm-hmm. since minds won't change, I think we can move on, and we're going to take up something much, much lighter in the heels.
So we're going to talk about our favorite Christmas presents that we received this holiday season. Do you want to start, Beth?
Sure. Well, first I'll say that it is a gift to us that you hung with us through a discussion about abortion, because we know that is a tough one, but, you know, we had to do it.
We had to do it.
Sarah, I remember a lot in college you talking about your now husband, Nicholas, who then you had first started dating, and you would walk around all the time and you would like put your index finger up and be like, Nicholas is a genius. You said it all the time. I'll never forget it. I'm happy to report that similarly, I married a genius who always does something unexpected and delightful with my gifts. And so this year was no exception. So I get this enormous box under the tree. He walked around, first of all, for a couple of days talking about how he had won Christmas. And I tried to tell him that Christmas is not a thing to win. But anyway, so giant box.
That is wrong, because we all know I won Christmas with my Christmas pudding. So we're going to have to, you're wrong there. I won Christmas, and I think your husband won Christmas. So
he thinks he won Christmas. Well, I guess everybody can get a Christmas trophy. How about that? Okay. So I open the box, and there's this tiny little black gadget in it that I do not recognize. And then there is an index card that has layers and layers of post-it notes on it. And so the first post-it note says, hello. And then the second, they go on, and I'm sensing some Adele lyrics, but I can't tell exactly what's happening. And then it instructs me to turn on little black device that I do not recognize, and I do, and hello, blast, Adele's voice all through our house. So anyway, he got me tickets to see Adele in Detroit, which I am super, super stoked about, and I love the way he gave it to me. And I also felt really embarrassed to find out that we owned that little black speaker for like months before Christmas, and I just didn't know that we had it or what it did. I mean, it could have launched, you know, a rocket ship to space for all I knew. I had no idea what it was, but it was delightful and really fun, and I am super excited to see Adele.
It is taking every ounce of willpower I have not to sing hello right now. Maybe we'll have Nicholas mix it in post-production.
I think that would be good. It also
just
makes
so as our Christmas present to all our listeners, they can sing it for the rest of the day.
It also makes me just want to get a manicure, you know?
Oh, she does. She has, and you know, Barbara Streisand's big on the nails and the hands.
She just
too.
Rocks those nails.
I just think that, is that a thing? Like, they have to do that? I don't know.
So what was your favorite gift this year?
So my favorite gift this year was not near as creative and exciting or even a surprise, as I said, this is what I want for Christmas. And so my husband went out and bought it, was a heated mattress pad. But it brings me so much joy. I can't even tell you.
That would bring me joy too.
Oh my God. I turn it on and then I go wash my face and I brush and floss my teeth. My bed is so warm when I get inside and it's just amazing and I love it so much. The other day I turned it on to high because it was really cold and I just sat in bed and worked all day. I just was like, that's my office.
Does it last like all night until you turn it off, or is it like the heated seat in a car that like fades after some time?
Well, first of all, Astra should say it's dual zone.
That's so, important.
Like, Nicholas controls his separately. But no, like usually I'll put, I mean, it'll stay high. It won't fade. If it's on high, it's going to stay at high. But like I'll either turn it off or turn it all the way down for the rest of the night. Because like once you're in bed, that's different. It's just getting into cold bed and your feet are cold. It's cold outside. It's awful. And now it's mine so cozy. I just love it.
Is it hard to get up?
Well, yeah.
I would think so.
It's so hard. But it's hard to get up anyway in the winter.
Well, another gift to us is that all of you listen to us. We just get so excited every time we hear from someone who is listening. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you to Sarah's husband, Nicholas the Genius, for being our executive producer. He does a fantastic job for us. And Sarah will tell you about our music, and we will see you during our next episode.
Our intro, interstitial, and outro music is Fourth and Starlight Road Instrumental by Minden and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial